beginning the next section of the fourth Satipatthana, and the next section will be on the seven enlightenment factors. And I have a bit of a plan for how to do it, and today what I'll do is, I really like to, Ajahn Kurnama's talk the other day of sort of viewing, kind of saying going back and looking at things as a roadmap, kind of coming back out. So today I'm going to read from Bhante Gunaratana's book, The Four Foundations of Mindfulness in Plain English, his chapter on the seven factors, just kind of giving an overview of all of them. And there's several different ways that the factors are talked about. One of them is in describing how that, you know, how they're useful or how they lead to enlightenment. One of them is the sort of sequential order that you develop mindfulness first and sort of perfect that, and then from that each of the factors sort of comes into awakening, and then you sort of go through all seven stages sequentially. And this is the way Bhante Gunaratana tends to talk about it, listening to some of his tapes and talks that he's given, retreats he does. Even he's more sort of specific and gives even more examples even than what he's written in this talk. So that's kind of the way he teaches, is this method. And then there's other talks about it where it's more sort of like holistic, or even sort of using individual characteristics to sort of balance out and other new hindrances or other ways of working with it. So there's kind of two different ways, but Bhante Gunaratana is definitely this, what I call sort of sequential method. So we'll go over that today, and then I'll even back up a little bit further than that tomorrow and sort of talk about how seven factors sort of fit into the whole picture of the Satipatthana Sutta, and then get into more details, sort of. Then we'll start, as Kurnadama's sort of analogy, and sort of we'll start zooming in on the map. So again, this is Bhante Gunaratana, The Four Foundations of Mindfulness in Plain English, Chapter 12, Factors of Enlightenment. The seven factors of enlightenment are the qualities we need to achieve the goal of our practice. As our meditation deepens and the fetters subside, these seven positive qualities arise in us, with mindfulness as their crown jewel. The seven factors help us defeat the forces of delusion that disturb our concentration and delay our progress on the path to liberation. The suttas tell a number of stories, like that of Mahakasapa, in which even hearing someone speak the names of the factors provides relief from pain, disease, and adversity. Once, when the Buddha himself was ill, Venerable Mahachunda recited the names of the seven factors, and the Buddha's grievous sickness disappeared. It is easy to memorize the list of the factors of enlightenment, and some people do, but it is not enough just to know what the factors are. We must understand the meaning of each factor and use our mindfulness to see them, to see when it is present, how it arises, and how to develop and maintain it. In Pali, the seven factors are known as bhojangas. The word comes from bodhi, which means enlightenment, and anga, which means limb. The seven factors we discuss in this chapter are the limbs, the arms and legs of enlightenment. Without them, we cannot walk the path to freedom from suffering. They arise in the same order for everyone. In fact, each marks a stage of our progress along the path. We cannot skip any stage because each develops naturally out of the one before. Let us look closely at each factor. Along that point, it's like one thing I noticed when I was reading this is that, like, when he's sometimes talking about one factor, it's interesting to note how many times he sort of talks about the next factor that will be, you know, kind of in there. It's like it's the next factors sometimes used to develop the one that you're in. So just quickly going over all seven of them is mindfulness or sati, investigation, dhammavicaya, energy, virya, joy, which is piti, tranquility is paucity, concentration, samadhi, and equanimity, upeka. Everything that we have been discussing so far pertains to mindfulness, so there is referring to the whole book of the Satipatthana Sutta. All progress on the path starts with this quality. As the Buddha said, mindfulness is the chief of all the dhammas. But in order for our mindfulness to become a factor leading to enlightenment, it has to be strong, focused, and specific. Here is how the Buddha described the special kind of mindfulness. Bhikkhus, on whatever occasion a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world, on that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in him. On whatever occasion unremitting mindfulness is established in a bhikkhu, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in him, and he develops it, and by development, he comes to fulfillment in him. What can we learn from these words? First, to be a factor of enlightenment, our mindfulness has to have a clear focus, such as the body as the body. We can also focus on feelings, thoughts, and phenomena. These four, of course, are the four foundations of mindfulness we have been considering. Next, we must be ardent and alert. That means that we meditate with effort and enthusiasm. Third, we must put aside covetousness and grief with regard to the world. In other words, we do not allow feelings and thoughts about ordinary day-to-day concerns to disturb our concentration. Actually, we should put aside greed and distress about the world all the time, not only when we're sitting in meditation. Finally, our mindfulness must be unremitting. In other words, we must practice mindfulness all the time, not just while in the meditation. In fact, we should practice mindfulness during all activities, whether we're walking, eating, drinking, or waiting for the bus. Because of mindfulness, even ordinary activities can be wholesome and beneficial. If we remember our mindfulness only occasionally, or practice it only during meditation sessions, it will take a very long time to develop the level necessary to liberate us from the fetters. Mindfulness becomes a factor of enlightenment only when we are fully engaged in being mindful every waking moment. As we have been discussing, mindfulness requires a specific kind of awareness in each instant of mindfulness. We are conscious of the changing nature of everything that happens to us. We recognize that none of it makes us permanently happy. Most important, we understand that there is no permanent self or soul who is experiencing any of this. When mindfulness is established as our constant attitude, we discover that we have been practicing the seven factors of enlightenment all along. When we meditate on mindfulness of the body as a body, we naturally use the factor of investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. The same is true when we meditate on mindfulness of feeling, thoughts, and phenomena. Our task now is to make our mindfulness even more steady and strong so that mindfulness itself becomes the factor of our meditation. As we continue to meditate in this way, mindfulness becomes a factor of enlightenment and speeds our progress on the path towards liberation. Okay, so the first next factor is investigation, Dhamma Vichaya. Wise people are inquisitive. Using our deeply cultivated mindfulness, we investigate the Dhamma or phenomena in our own mind and body. Turning inward in this way happens naturally when our mindfulness factor is strong and clear. The focus of our investigation is the five aggregates. Our mindfulness inquires everywhere into form, feeling, perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. We see the arising of the breath, postures, clear comprehension, parts of the body, the four elements, 108 types of feelings, the five hindrances, six senses, the 10 fetters that arise dependent on the senses and their objects. We see their disappearing nature. We investigate all of them with powerful mindfulness. How do we investigate? The process is the same for us as it was in the Buddha's time. We listen to the Dhamma, remember what we have heard, and then examine the meaning of the Dhamma we have learned. If anything is unclear or doubts arise, we ask questions, we think, we discuss. We focus our mindfulness on every aspect of our life and activities, on and off the cushion. For instance, when a thought arises, we investigate to see whether it is spiritually beneficial. We ask, does this thought reduce my greed and hatred or increase them? Does it minimize my confusion or add to it? Does it make me and others peaceful? If we discover that the thought increases greed, hatred, and delusion, and destroys peace and happiness, we ask, what can I do to eliminate it? If we discover that the thought is wholesome, we ask, what can I do to maintain it? Is my mindfulness sufficient? If not, how can I improve it? We use the same method to investigate the other aggregates. For instance, we inquire into our feelings by asking, am I attached to pleasant feeling? Do I reject unpleasant feeling? How many times have I been distracted from my mindfulness by desire for pleasant objects or hatred for unpleasant ones? We also investigate how well we understand essential Dhamma concepts, such as impermanence. We ask, does it occur to me that the body is mine? What makes me think that it is mine? Do I see that the body parts and elements are always changing? Perhaps we discover that our understanding of impermanence is not very clear. We suspect that the confusion may be why the thought that the body is mine keeps coming back. As a result, we resolve, I will spend more time meditating on the body's impermanence. We also examine our everyday actions and attitudes. We ask, how many times have I gotten angry when someone pointed out my faults? How many times have I enjoyed criticizing others? How many times have I taken pleasure in gossiping or quarreling? If we find that our actions and attitudes are healthy, we investigate how to maintain and strengthen them. If we find that they need to be improved, we figure out what to do to change them. As we can see from these examples, it is our job to make sure that we understand the four foundations of mindfulness and apply this understanding to our meditation and our life. No one can do this hard work for us. We have to manage our own body, mind, and actions every moment of our waking life. No one can walk the path on our behalf. We use mindfulness and intelligent investigation to check whether what we are doing is holding us back or helping us move forward towards our goal. The attitude we should adapt is called come and see. Nobody has invited us to investigate the Dhamma. There's no place we have to go to engage in this investigation, and there's nothing we can see with our eyes. Rather, the truth of what we experience all the time invites our attention. The truth is called Dhamma. It invites us, saying, if you want to be free from troubles, look at me. As the sutta tells us, the Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, to be personally experienced by the wise. So, energy, or virya. As we continue our investigation of the five aggregates, we become more and more interested in what is going on. That interest arouses the energy to make even greater effort to stay on course. We experience enthusiasm, along with the determination never to give up. This combination is the energy factor of enlightenment. A simple example illustrates how investigation arouses energy. When we watch with mindfulness and attention, anything we experience seems to follow a trajectory similar to the motion of a stone thrown into the air. The stone rises as strongly as the power we use to throw it, but as it moves upwards, the rising energy reduces and the speed slows down. Eventually, the upward motion stops. Finally, the stone reverses course and falls to the ground. Seeing this, we become interested in checking to see whether every instance of feeling, thought, perception, consciousness follows this pattern. This interest generates the determination to be even more mindful, and the energy factor leads to enlightenment develops within us. When mindfulness combines with the element factor of energy, we are increasingly able to use skillful effort to keep from getting caught in greed, hatred, and delusion. Skillful effort helps us distinguish between thoughts and feelings we should welcome and those we must avoid. When harmful impulses arise, we close the doors of our senses to suffocate them. Then we use effort to replace them with beneficial impulses such as generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. Because our energy is aroused, we are not lenient. We do not let down our guard for even an instant. As the sutta tells us, realizing that this body is as fragile as a clay pot, and fortifying this mind like a well-fortified city, drive out delusion with the sword of wisdom. Until the final battle is won, we use energetic effort to safeguard, secure, and maintain what we have gained. But our energy is calm and focused rather than hyper-intensive. Skillful mindfulness, skillful investigation, and skillful effort work together like a well-trained team to purify the mind. We recognize that life is as brief as a flash of lightning, but there is still a chance to liberate ourselves from the cycle of suffering. As the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, proclaimed with profound determination, "Let my body dry up, my flesh wither away, my body be reduced to a skeleton, I will not give up what humanly can be attained." Joy, pity. When the energy factor of enlightenment is strong, joy arises as a factor of deep concentration meditation. The stage of deep concentration meditation, called the jhanas, takes us beyond the ordinary mindfulness that we have been talking about into a series of deep tranquility, harmonious, and powerful states. As mentioned earlier, I described the jhana states in detail in the book Beyond Mindfulness in Plain English, which we have in our library. As we progress through the progressive stages of jhana, the five hindrances are put to sleep and the 10 fetters are neutralized, making our concentration even stronger. When the hindrances of ill will is overcome, our meditation becomes joyful. The emotion relaxes the body and mind, generating a feeling of serenity and peace. As our concentration deepens further, we experience five increasingly intense feelings of joy: minor joy, momentary joy, showering joy, uplifting joy, and all-pervading joy. Minor joy makes your body hair stand on end. Momentary joy is like lightning flashing moment after moment. Showering joy descends on the body and then disappears, like waves breaking on the seashore. Uplifting joy is able to lift the physical body, actually to move it. The sutta tells the story of a young girl who aroused uplifting joy while contemplating the thought of a shrine. Carried by uplifting joy, the girl traveled to the shrine through the air, arriving before her parents, who went there on foot. All-pervading joy suffuses every part of the body. It's important to keep in mind that the joy we experience in the initial stages of jhana is not the same as the pleasurable feeling of everyday life. And even within the jhana states, the joy that is one of the seven factors of enlightenment arises only as a result of the development of the three previous factors: mindfulness, investigation, and energy. Mindfulness combined with investigation shines light into the dark areas of the mind. Energy drives our tireless effort to see reality as it is, moving additional obstacles to the attainment of enlightenment. As obstacles subside, the special kind of joy that has the factor of enlightenment arises in the mind. This joy is more durable than the joy that we experience in the initial stages of jhana, because it comes from understanding. Enlightenment joy never becomes weak or fades. And when we reach this state, we remain joyful all the time. Tranquility, paucity. When enlightenment joy is developed and perfected, the factor of tranquility arises. Tranquility is a mental state in which the mind and body are calm, relaxed, and peaceful. There's no part of us that is not steady, still, and tranquil. Desire, grief, and delusion have disappeared. We feel satisfied, safe, and secure. We do not feel like moving the body, nor do we feel thirsty, hungry, tired, bored, or lazy. Everything is serene and perfect. Although we have not yet achieved the final goal of our practice, for the moment, we enjoy profound peace and happiness. Concentration, samadhi. In this state of joy and tranquility, concentration becomes noticeably stronger and more focused. In each stage of mindfulness meditation, our concentration our concentration is unsteady. Moments of clear focus alternate with moments in which we are aware of our internal dialogue and of sounds, smells, and other sense impressions. Increasingly, these distractions fade into the background, and we are able to concentrate exclusively on the breath or other objects for longer and longer periods. This improved ability to focus is called access concentration. It marks the boundary between ordinary meditation and the jhana states of deep concentration. As we progress through the stages of jhana, concentration becomes a factor of enlightenment. Using concentration as a powerful tool, we focus the mind like a laser beam on the five aggregates. Our concentration penetrates to the three universal characteristics of all conditioned things: the reality of constant change, the unsatisfactory nature of everything that exists, and the complete absence of a permanent self or soul. These characteristics are no longer a theory. We recognize them as essential truths. In jhana, mindfulness and concentration work together to dissolve all barriers to achieve realization. And the final factor, equanimity, upekkha. Equanimity is like the center point of an old-fashioned balance scale. On one side of the scale, we place a heap of rice. On the other side, we place a metal weight. We adjust the quantity of rice until the pointer on the scale is exactly perpendicular. Then we know that we have the correct measurement. This balancing point is equanimity. In the state of jhana, we use equanimity like a balancing scale to fine-tune our cultivation of the other enlightenment factors. If we find that the mind is sluggish, we intensify our mindfulness and investigation in order to arouse our energy and restore balance. If the mind is overexcited, we focus on increasing our joy, tranquility, and concentration so that we become more calm. The equanimity that we experience in the jhana states differs from the type we use in mindfulness meditation to balance harmful and beneficial feelings. The equanimity based on sensual objects, form, sounds, smells, taste, and touch, is called equanimity based on diversity. In the jhana states, the equanimity that arises as a factor of enlightenment is called equanimity based on unity, because it focuses on a single internal object. At this last stage of the path, all the components of the body and mind, the five aggregates in the past, present, and future, are exactly the same. There is no such thing as good, bad, or indifferent. It is all simply reality, impermanent, unsatisfactory, and selfless. In this state of perfect balance, the sutta tells us, clinging to the material things of the world, cease utterly without remainder. He has a few points here about developing concentration meditation, but I'll skip that for right now. With that last part, I found this from Ajahn Amaro talking about equanimity. Last year I was doing some research on the 10 perfections, 10 baramis, and equanimity is one of those. And this was a note that Ajahn Amaro had on He actually sort of goes through and talks about three different types of equanimity. Bhante-ji mentioned two there, the equanimity based on diversity and equanimity based on unity. And then Ajahnamara brings in the atamiyata as a third sort of quality. I just thought I'd talk about those. So he had a nice little sort of way of sort of summing up these, a way of thinking of those three different qualities. So he said equanimity based on diversity is, he said, there's lots of things happening in your mind and say your meditation, but your equanimity is like steady, like as a post. Then he said equanimity based on unity, said, you know, there's still lots happening, but only one thing. But you're focusing in on only one thing. And then atamiyata is letting go of the whole subject-object duality. And so he has a definition of atamiyata as literally is not made of that. Bhikkhu Bodhi has it identified as non-identification. And Ajahn Jeff, one of the translations, is non-fashioning. And then Ajahn Pasano, Lumpur Pasano gave me... I was talking about this breakfast one morning, he told me that Prapayuto had just come up with something where defining the word maya of atamiyata is holding a banner. And so atamiyata then is not holding a banner, not needing to hold our views, our prejudices, and our opinions, not needing things to go our way, to letting go of everything, of even having an agenda. And I have this down as part of the whole thing of the Barmies. It said it's all about connection. And with connection, you don't need to be right. You need to be real. And then earlier where Bhante-ji was talking about the kind of different qualities of energy, this was from that same sort of class. There's talked about many times three different ways of talking about energy, the initial, putting forth that initial application, then the sort of when you're developing all these enlightenment factors, there's what they call sort of the arousing of the factor. So it's like when it first sort of starts coming into being. And Bhante-ji sort of clarifies that as sort of saying like with mindfulness, when it becomes an enlightenment factor, it's like as soon as it's aroused, what he means by there is when it's actually continuous for 24 hours a day, like, you know, every waking moment, you are mindful. He says there's a very distinct knowing of that. It's not enlightenment, but it's the arousing of the enlightenment factor. But even that, it's not 100% solid. Like, it's just coming to being, so that's the initial stage. But then you keep going to it, you keep working with it. He says is like you work with it with the investigation. So it's like the next one that rises, you're working with it with investigation to figure out how to maintain it, how to keep it there. And then so that is the next stage, developing it. And then the final stage is when it is solid. And then when it becomes solid, then that actually arises your Dhamma Vichaya has become really strong because you've been developing, getting that mindfulness to be really 100% pure. And so your Dhamma Vichaya becomes sort of continuous 24 hours a day. And then that's when that factor has become aroused. And that's in the initial stage. It is an enlightenment factor, but it's initial stage. So this is from Bhikkhu Bodhi talking about the energy in that same way. So the first one is Arambha Dhatu, the element of putting forth effort or the initial attack. Bhikkhu Bodhi calls it investigating energy. Our initial application of energy or effort will falter when new skills are learned, and there will be some unsteadiness as we also will meet with inner conflict. But one makes the determination to practice and put forth the initial effort. The next one is Nekama Dhatu, the element of stepped up effort or exertion. Bhikkhu Bodhi calls this persevering energy. Persisting in the endeavor we have been practicing, the energy will be building during the stage. Also, as one is carried along, it will still need to have that determined effort. And then Parakamadhatu, the element of striving towards success, Bhikkhu Bodhi calls this inevitable or non-retreating energy. One's energy becomes so strong that it seems to almost swell up spontaneously. It is so strong it seems to carry us along, but we have to realize it is the product of practicing the first two, Aramba and Nekamadhatu. So that's the presentation for this morning. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts? I really do recommend if after the retreat's over, the talks that I was listening to of his were the Satipatthana Sutta in 1999. He gave two retreats, and the one I've been listening to is the second retreat, because it had the titles were much more. The other ones, it just sort of gives the dates of the talks, but the second, I think it's like in September or something like that, he gives the talks are all titled. And he's even more clear in the audio tapes than he is in his book. Okay.